Women's Health Center, providing comprehensive reproductive and sexual health services for all women of all ages at all stages since 1984. Insurance, main care, Dirgo, and self-pay accepted. MabelWadsworth.org.
It's 10 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at WERU.org. A Camden Conference special with host Jim Campbell is up next.
Good morning and welcome to this special broadcast featuring presentations from the 2014 Camden Conference. I'm Jim Campbell. On today's program, we'll hear two short presentations from the 2014 conference. The theme of this year's conference was the global politics of food and water. And not surprisingly, many of the presentations dealt with the challenges we face as the human family in feeding a population that will reach over 9 billion people by the year 2050. Today, though, we'll hear two short presentations from the conference which focused on some solutions to those food and water challenges. After those presentations, which will last about 25 minutes, you're invited to call in to offer your reactions and comments and suggestions about how we might best provide food and water to a world of 9 billion human beings. The number will be 1-866-625-9378, which is 625-WERU. The first presentation today is from Kathleen Merrigan, who is a former Undersecretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and currently works as a consultant with Organic Valley, which is an organic milk-producing company. Her comments will be followed by those of Shelley Pingree, Congresswoman from Maine's 1st Congressional District, who is herself a farmer. So let's begin with an excerpt from Kathleen Merrigan's presentation at the conference entitled Opportunities for Big Climate Solutions from Small-Scale Production. Note that both of the speakers do mention slides, but the slides aren't necessary to follow their presentations. Here's Kathleen Merrigan.
I want to start by just complimenting the conference organizers. I have always said throughout my career, which has been very D.C. focused, that change does not begin in Washington, D.C. And it's about communities engaged in the kind of learning enterprise that you're all involved in that's really, really exciting. And the energy comes from outside of Washington, and you bring it back to that crazy world that I live in. And that crazy world I live in also has in a profoundly imaginative and courageous leader in Shelley Pingree. And I just want to give her a shout out. She's become a friend. And against all odds, she made some good progress in this latest 2014 Farm Bill. I also want to mention, since my role is to talk about small farms, that USDA has a really great and super unused tool on their website called the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food Compass. It's a geospatial mapping tool, and you can find out what federal investments, not just USDA, but other departments of the federal government, what investments they're making to facilitate local and regional and organic agriculture. We spent a lot of time building this, and I thought it was like that Kevin Costner movie, Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. We built it. We need you to come. So go and take a look at that. When I was a graduate school professor at Tufts University, I would give my students paper assignments, and I had the greatest students from all over the world, really, great students. And I would read these papers, and they would be incredibly well-researched and documented and beautifully written, but they were all about the problem, not about the solution. Because solutions are really hard to come up with. It's easier to write about the problems. At a certain point in my career, I instituted a rule that when you send me a research paper, a third of it has to be solution-oriented. So I decided to take that as my challenge here today. And I want to very briefly give you four ideas, things that are happening out in the countryside domestically, but we could talk about it in the global frame as well, where I think there's some creative things happening that we should incent that we should applaud. Now, livestock is a big area when you talk about climate change. The Food Agricultural Organization projected that between the years 2005 to 2050, that there would be an increase of 70% in livestock consumption in the world. So much for Meatless Monday, huh? I mean, we just know that that's true because as the world becomes wealthier, more developed, people start eating more livestock products. So even if we start as this country, and we should, start reducing some of our livestock consumption, we still have a pretty big challenge. And one of the things that we see in this country in particular over the years has been a decoupling of livestock and crop production, which is, you know, just goes against all the things I taught my students about the nutrient recycling that we would try to have in a sustainable system. So I want to talk about dairy in particular, and in part because my last 7 months as a recovering Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, I've mainly spent my efforts working for Organic Valley, which is an 1,800 farmer member cooperative across the country. It has the brand name Organic Valley. And the thing I was working on was looking at research that they had compiled from their farms where they were looking at what is the role of grass-based dairy. So these slides that you're seeing a lot of grass. Cows on grass. How crazy is that? I mean, cows, they're ruminants, right? They're meant to eat grass, and yet we are stuffing them full of grain. And we came up with this slogan based on some research I'll show you that is more grass, less gas. Right? Because that's what a cow naturally wants to eat. A study came out in PLOS ONE, it's an online academic journal, open access to everybody, that talked about a comprehensive 18-month study. Chuck Benbrook was the lead author of that study, Washington State University, and talked about high omega-3s, CLAs, better ratio of omega-6 to 3 in milk from grass-based cows. That's all about human health. But the part that I really want to emphasize today is that about the methane, the gas. We found in a pilot study we call the Greener Cow Study that was done collaboratively with Stonyfield and Organic Valley is that there was 12% less emissions from cows on grass, similar production. So there's a real opportunity there for small farms. And I think that we should consider small farms in their role because in the last census, and I'll talk about the census of agriculture in a minute, every 5 years or so the USDA does a census of agriculture. In the last census, 95% of dairies had less than 500 cows, about 62,000 dairies. So trying to figure out constructive systems for these small dairy farms makes sense. And in our study that we did, the Greener Cow Study, I'm embracing it now as a consultant to Organic Valley, we figured that if every dairy went that way, these small dairies, it would be the equivalent of taking 500,000 cars off the road. So it's no small amount of thing to consider. All right, my next thing, my next solution. I like these little slogans, right? Poop to power. Have you heard that one before? So a lot of effort going on around the country to come up with methane digesters. So I've been to, dairy operations could be 10,000 cows. I mean, I just gave you the statistic that most of them are under 500, but we have some really huge ones in this country. And not just conventional, there's some really huge organic ones too. And I've seen these huge manure, uncovered, waiting to be environmental disaster, pits of manure that gives off incredibly toxic greenhouse gases. And so the question is, how do we do better there? And one of the things we're doing is trying to put caps on those, capture that methane and other anaerobic byproducts, and make biogas out of it. Now this requires, of course, capital. And it can be very expensive. I remember visiting a methane digester of a small farm, 250 cows maybe in Pennsylvania, and I think we put in about $1 million to make that happen. I just saw a Minnesota Department of Agriculture sheet that said about $500,000 for a digester for 149 cow dairy operation. So it's expensive, but I still think that we can get those prices down. It's really important. Right now, most of the methane digesters, and there are not that many in this country, are being used in the larger operations, but there's real potential there. And it's something that USDA is starting to put money in. So I really am interested in that as a possible solution. Third thing I want to talk to you about is agroforestry. Here's my slogan: the right tree in the right place for the right purpose. That's actually USDA's slogan because they just came out with an agroforestry strategic plan and a report on progress to date. They say less than 1% of the available land in this country that's suitable for agroforestry is actually practicing some version of agroforestry. Okay, so with the bright lights here in my face, I can't see anyone's faces, but you're probably saying, agro what? That's the reaction I get a lot of people. I got introduced to agroforestry by one of my graduate students who was actually doing research in Bangladesh. And I understood better how they were incorporating deliberately trees into crop and animal livestock production. And it's something that communities have practiced all over the world. But here in this country, we distinctly have the forest stuff over here and agriculture stuff over here. And that's so well symbolized when you go to Washington, D.C. and you're at the Smithsonian Mall and you see all the museums. You also see the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is a huge building connected to buildings connected. And then there's the Forest Service diagonally across the street, not even physically connected. And you hear people say USDA and the Forest Service. But there's such great opportunity with alley cropping and forest farming and silvopasture, riparian forest buffers, windbreaks. There's all kinds of things that we can be doing on our farms that will make them more economically viable, but also much more sustainable, and which much research has shown will help with climate change. There's a University of Florida study out that shows that, and they look not just at the US, but they were looking globally at a lot of different sites, that agroforestry systems store significantly more carbon in deeper layers of the soil compared to treeless farms, and that the carbon levels increase with the denser the tree cover and the more diverse the tree cover. You also have North Carolina State. They're coming out now with studies saying that all farmers who are concerned with climate change and worries about drought and flooding should be engaged in alley cropping as a really incredibly important mitigation tool. All right, four. I don't really have the best slogan for this, but I'm going to use it anyhow. Panic for organic. Now, that may bring you back to the olden days when Meryl Streep was all worried about ALAR and apples, and there was this huge effort to establish national organic standards. We've come a long way since then, and I'm going to say there could be a good panic for organic, and that is because, and I know this will get some conversation going on our panel, so what the heck, I really believe that organic agriculture has pioneered some of the most important practices that are sustainable and that help with climate change. Crop rotations are the cornerstone of organic agriculture, always have been. I hear a lot now nationally, certainly USDA is talking a lot more about cover crops, a very common organic practice. Use of perennials. You go to West Jackson and what's going on in the Land Institute, and they show what really incredible sequestration you can have with a lot of these perennials. Really exciting stuff. So organic is really something that we shouldn't say, that's just something for the less than productive small guys. I do think that, vast majority of farmers are organic when you think of it in a global scale, and that there's real opportunity there. So my time is coming to a close very quickly. I do want to say that, going back to the census, we have some very interesting preliminary numbers here in Maine. The data that's come out from USDA is still preliminary because we had that little problem of a government shutdown in the fall. And so they just gave the first tranche of data, and we'll get more delivered to us in May. But it's a treasure trove of information, and you know, a lot of analysts just dive right in. And I first looked at your main numbers, and I saw that in your really small scale, the smallest scale size farms, you've actually lost in this census some numbers between 1 and 179 acres. Those, there are three categories there. You've lost 523 farms. But you've gained 140 in that category of 180 to 449. And I think that's really good because that's getting to the scale of farm that you're probably going to be able to make it for the long term, and you may be able to do it without off-farm income. I was unfortunately caught up in travel last night. I missed Fred's presentation, but he has so eloquently over the years described this disappearing middle of American agriculture, where we have this growth in small farms and we have this growth in large farms, but it's that disappearing middle we should be really worried about. So you have 140 in that mid-sized scale that have really dotted your scene, and maybe some of those ones in the lower categories actually scaled up to a larger size farm. And then you had two more farms in the 500 to 999 acres and 33 in the 1,000 and more acres. But it just seems to me these are very interesting numbers. You're in a state that is really excited about local, regional food, organic food, small farms. And so these censuses, when they come out every 5 years, gives us a real opportunity to take a hard look at what's going on across the state. Shelley Pingree, I was at a reception a few weeks ago. Pat Leahy spoke first, the senator from Vermont and the author of a lot of local and organic law over time. And Shelley got right up there and she said, you know, Maine's the new Vermont. So keep it up. Thank you.
We've been listening to Kathleen Merrigan, former Undersecretary of the Department of Agriculture, speaking at the 2014 Camden Conference here on Community Radio, WERU-FM. And although we don't have his comments right here, John Piotti, who is the head of the Maine Farmland Trust, wound up being the moderator for the Camden Conference. And he commented on those numbers of small farms and said that even though it appears that we have lost some small farmers in this latest census, that actually over the decade, Maine has had a significant increase in farms of all sizes, including those small farms that Kathleen Merrigan mentioned. We're going to turn now to a presentation from Shelley Pingree, who is our congresswoman from the 1st Congressional District here in Maine, after which we'll be taking your calls if you'd like to call in and comment on anything you've heard or offer some ideas about how we're going to feed and provide water for a planet of 9 billion people. The number, 1-866-625-WERU. That's 625-9378. Shelley Pingree's presentation is about 13 minutes, so at that conclusion, we'll have the phone lines open. So here is Shelley Pingree speaking on food security challenges facing Maine and the United States at the 2014 Camden Conference in February.
I have a lot of slides to show, and if I start talking too fast, I'll just do my best. So let's get it going. Let's just start with this. It's an economic principle that says if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. And I worry that our current approach to food systems and agriculture cannot go on forever. I know you've all spent quite a bit of time talking about what's wrong. Let me just go over a few things, and hopefully, as the good secretary asked us all, I'll get to a few hopeful things in the end. So in my opinion, the indicators are just no longer a warning. They are really starting to frighten us all. Fishermen, farmers, people around the country are really getting worried about what's happening to our food system, global warming, so many of the things that we care about. Clara Waterman, who was a longtime North Haven resident, died at 101 at the Knox Center a couple of years ago, was a great fifth grade teacher. And she made sure everybody everybody knew about the life cycle of the monarch. That was her trademark. And she talked to young kids about the life cycle of the monarch, how they flew to Mexico every year. Well, in 1996, there were 1 billion monarchs that made their way down to Mexico. In 2006, there were 300 million. In 2012, only 60 million made it, and 1 year later, 2013, it's 30 million. They used to take up 50 acres of pine forest, just a football field they covered last year. So what's up? Most likely, this is about the decline of milkweed, their main food. There's just nothing to eat on the way. 90% of the milkweed is gone in Ohio. This correlates with a plotting of the monarch migration with the use of Roundup. We've talked a lot about those things already in the conference. In my opinion, this isn't that complex. Farmers are planting more GMO corn and soybeans. They're Roundup resistant. They use more Roundup in their practices to get rid of the weeds. Milkweed isn't resistant, and it disappears. So let's go back to it. If something can't go on forever, it will stop. So the question is, in some ways, how did we get here? What are we going to do next? I'm just going to talk a little bit, although John did a great job of saying, how did I get here? I was born in Minnesota. I always have to admit that to you Mainers in the room. Thank you. I came from the state where people say, yeah, sure, you betcha. But I've been working on my accent for a long time. This is my family on their farm in Kenyon, Minnesota. That was my grandmother with a lovely hat. And that's me, the little girl with the kitten. We were Norwegians. We were immigrants to this country and came here because of the wonderful farming opportunities. But I came to Maine in 1971, like many of you did. I followed a boy, and we had a copy of Helen and Scott Nearing's Living the Good Life. So we were interested in sustainable farming. We started a farm on North Haven, sold milk, eggs, vegetables to our neighbors. I raised my kids there. Yes, that is Hannah with the piglet. And as you heard, I was lucky. I had a great background in agriculture. I had gone to College of the Atlantic. I did the composting operation as my work-study program. I learned under Elliot Coleman. Back to the Land movement was big then. People cared about sustainable farming, growing our own food. But let's face it, in 1971, it was kind of a hippie Birkenstock Back to the Land thing, and agriculture policy was going in the opposite direction. Earl Butz, the Secretary of Agriculture under Richard Nixon, said, get big or get out. And that's the way we looked at it. So fast forward to the 90s. I was lucky enough to be elected to the Maine Senate. This was my district. In fact, I gave my first political speech ever in this room. Doesn't mean I feel at home, but but you know, there I was in the Maine, in the legislature in the 90s. We were making some progress. I served on the Agriculture Committee, but look, GMO legislation wasn't going very far. Irradiated food, bovine growth hormone, we were talking about it, but we weren't quite there yet. Fast forward to today, the Maine legislature, with Republican and Democratic support, passed a GMO labeling bill, and I'm lucky enough to be in Congress. You heard that I own a wonderful farm with my husband Donald on North Haven. We run the inn, a restaurant, have a CSA for winter greens. This experience and being able to do this has been invaluable as a policymaker. I know a lot about what's going on in the market and people's interests. I understand the Food Safety Modernization Act and the implications of regulations on small farmers, and I get to work on a wonderful farm whenever I have a day off, even processing chickens. I'm an excellent eviscerator, so don't mess with me. But I know that people love to go to these wonderful farms, and I know that this is happening around the country, that people, as you heard in Maine, the average age of our farmers going down, the number of farms is going up, and we have great potential here. When you see those maps of the future breadbasket, you know, Maine was the breadbasket of the Union Army in the Civil War, somebody reminded me last night. And in the 1860s, North Haven had 79 farms because you could get your goods to market, and this was the heart of the agricultural economy. Now, there are plenty of worrisome signs, and I won't go through all of them because you've talked about so many, but the bee colony collapse, the issues around who's going to pollinate our crops, all kinds of worries about the toxics, the chemicals, soil runoff. Oh, I got my head of myself there. So those are the bees. Soil runoff, you heard some wonderful conversations about the lack of topsoil. The drought in California, the severe weather that we're facing. And let's face it, if we're going to talk about climate change, Agriculture is a big polluter. They produce a lot of carbon. Your average vegetable travels 1,400 miles and spends 7 to 14 days in transit before it gets to you. We can't sustain that. So you heard a little bit about the Farm Bill. What are we going to do to overhaul this? The Secretary said it's not perfect, and it wasn't. But I did introduce a title to it. I worked a lot with my Republican colleagues. We managed to get a variety of good things in there to help small farmers. Things to encourage more farmers markets, to allow you to use your food stamp benefits at farmers markets or to join a CSA. You're going to hear from Gus Shortley, who did amazing work to double your benefits at a food at a farmers market, so if you're low income, you can buy more vegetables. Supporting food hubs, community kitchens, grants to build more hoop houses so we extend the season in states like this, helping out young farmers, getting crop insurance to be more appropriate, investing in organic agriculture. We put a lot of good things in there, and many of them we did with our Republican colleagues. But there is a lot we didn't get right. Vegetables are called specialty crops. Everything else is a commodity. Just to give you a sense of it, federal spending $269 million over the last 4 years on vegetables, $19 billion, 70 times as much on commodities. To give you a little more of a graphic, this is the healthy food plate, the way you should be eating today, lots of grains and vegetables, a little bit of protein. If you put the subsidies on there, you get a sense of what it looks like. That tiny little sliver is your specialty crops and fruits and vegetables. When you have time for a long tutorial, I'll go into all the details about how we took out direct payments to farmers. Those were hideous. We shouldn't have had them. But we replaced it with a crop insurance system that is technically a price support system. We set the prices high. It's going to be subsidized by you taxpayers. It's going to cost us billions of dollars. So we didn't get everything right. Now, I'm not ready to give up, and I'm going to give you two reasons why I'm not. There will be another farm bill, and with any luck, I'll get a chance to work on it. We do it every 5 years, so I got to stick around for that. But we're doing a lot of things right in the markets. You can see enormous expansion of farmers markets in this country. The biggest trend in retail today in grocery stores is local and organically sourced produce. Walmart wants to become the largest seller of organic produce in this country. They're already the largest retailer. We want to make sure they don't buy it all in China, but we think it's a great opportunity. In restaurants, the hottest trend is locally sourced foods, and a lot of people say to me, isn't this elitist? Oh, get over that. Maine is the 30th state per capita income, and you tell me how many small towns have a farmer's market or a local diner that serves things that they bought from the farmer down the road. People here don't have a lot of money, but they like to eat, and they want to invest it in locally grown healthy food. And programs like the one that Gus is doing to get the Double Bucks program so people who have to survive on SNAP benefits can get double the vegetables is very, very popular. So let's say it. The market is changing. It changed the Farm Bill. It's changing buyers' habits. It's one of the best weapons we have to change the food system. I want to tell you about one more weapon that we have as I wrap up. Now, some of this is in the hands of all of you. It has to do with where you buy your food, and it has to do with what kind of an activist you are. So, as quickly as I can, I'm going to go over this story of lean, finely textured beef. Now, we have all different opinions about lean, finely textured beef, better known as pink slime. And so no matter how you feel about this, this is an activist story of what people can do when they take on an issue. You might have seen something about pink slime in the Food Incorporated movie in 2008 in Food Inc. They showed you how one processing facility took away all the last little bits of beef and then used ammonium hydroxide to make sure you didn't get E. coli when you ate it. And if you watched that movie, you said, ooh, that's a little bit unpleasant, but it seems to be in our food supply, 70% of the hamburger had it. The New York Times did a story in 2009, which also raised public awareness. Jamie Oliver, like a lot of chefs who's gotten really involved in this issue of food and where it comes from, did a TV show, his Food Revolution show, and very graphically described what happens when you pick all these pieces off the last bits of a cow and add ammonia. He said, we just want to see it labeled. Well, in 2012, McDonald's, Burger King all announced that they would no longer use lean, finely textured beef in their burgers. So consumers were getting aware and said, we don't want to eat this anymore. But it was still added in the school lunch program. It was available in the food commodities we were going to ship to our kids. So we did all the regular things. My colleagues and I sent a letter to the USDA and said, please don't put this in the commodity program. I submitted a bill and said, just let the consumer know, just label the product. But it wasn't really until a mom in Texas named Bettina Siegel decided to start a change.org petition. She said, this isn't like anything I ever do. She had a food blog talking about school lunches, but she didn't expect to be doing this. On her first day, she got 1,000 names. It then became an ABC News story. They ran it over and over again. Before you know it, she had 220,000 signatures. And the USDA reacted and said, well, we'll give schools a choice. We will let them choose what they want to put in their school lunch program. That was an enormous change. It changed people's awareness of things. It changed how our kids get fed. And what she said to us was, because of the internet, the playing field is leveled. It is. It's changed dramatically today. Consumers have more power than they ever did before. So ask yourself, what's your petition going to be? Are you going to plant milkweed outside your house? Or are you just going to make sure that, like all the other wonderful Mainers, you can, or wherever you are from, you continue to buy locally grown food? You care about the fact that it's sustainably grown food. You ask what's in it. You talk to the farmer eye to eye if you get the chance. You ask how it's processed. You ask your elected officials where they stand. We have a lot of work to do to change this food system. If there's anything you've learned over the last day and a half, we have a lot to do. But I want you to know I have hope. I believe we're going to do this, and I thank you all for giving me the time to talk about it. Thank you very much.
That was Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, our congressperson from the 1st Congressional District here in Maine, speaking on food security challenges facing Maine and the United States. That presentation was taken from the 2014 Camden Conference at the end of February this year. Now it's your turn. 1-866-625-9378, or WERU if you're so inclined. You're welcome to call in and offer your reactions either to those presentations that we've heard this morning or to the larger question of the global politics of food and water, which was the theme of the 27th Annual Camden Conference. Once again, the number is 866-625-9378. And while you're moving over to the phone, we hope, I'll read you a little bit from the Camden Conference brochure that set up some of the questions that the conference was dealing with. Few topics inspire stronger and more sharply differing opinions, even emotions, than food and water. That's true whether it's at the global political level we'll be considering this weekend, or at the level of Maine's farm and fisheries. Adequate food and clean water are necessities of life over which the world is increasingly in conflict as the global population expands and usable resources contract. Tasty, nutritious food and ample fresh water are central to the way life should be, but does that mean local organic food and careful stewardship of water, or eating what you want when you want it year-round and unrestricted use of water? These are changes we tend to care about intensely and about which even the best of friends and neighbors may disagree. Throw in climate change, a phenomenon that our program committee has had to consider in formulating this year's conference, and emotions tend to ratchet up even further. Once again, the number 1-866-625-9378. Continuing from the Camden Conference brochure, while over 95% of climate scientists accept that climate change is happening and humans are a significant cause, polls show that many individuals still dispute human responsibility. That skepticism becomes more comprehensible if we consider how frightening both the consequences of climate change and many of the prescribed remedies can be. If the facts are clear, the appropriate responses are not. I think we have a caller. Caller, when you come on, would you please give your name and the town you're from? Just your first name is fine.
Good morning. I'm Lindy in Southwest Harbor. Thank you for airing Shelley's talk. I really need that today. What we eat is very important and where it's coming from. And my praise for the people who are working on this issue, but I just wanted to also introduce that we are lucky to have food to eat. Right now there's a silence on the, what's going on in Syria, and I'd just like to bring it to the people's attention that over a million children are starving, and there's an epidemic of polio there, being, and the children are being denied their vaccinations as well as food. So I encourage people to call the representatives and ask what the United States is doing about Syria as we speak. This is a humanitarian issue. It's not a political issue. There's a genocide in Syria, as there is in Ukraine, Venezuela, and all over the world. So while we are so lucky to have people like Shelley Pingree and our organic farmers and a radio station like ERU, let's bring our love and compassion and extend it out to the people who are starving as we speak. Keep the innocence in your heart and soul today. Thank you today for WERU. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for your call. That is an interesting point. We tried to concentrate more on U.S. and Maine situations today in the program that we are listening to today. But in former Camden Conference presentations from this conference, we've heard about some of the difficulties that are facing the planet. There are now about 7 billion people in the world, and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization thinks that about 900 million of those 7 billion people are hungry and do not have what are referred to as food security. Again, if you have a comment or a suggestion or a question, 1-866-625-9378. I think we have another caller. Caller, could you just please give us your first name and your town?
Hi, this is Florence Reed with Sustainable Harvest International in Ellsworth.
Mm-hmm.
And I am calling because I wanted to bring up a part of the conference that I felt was lacking. I felt that there wasn't a lot of focus on solutions to the food issues, and what there was often focused on GMOs and then by association the agrochemicals that go with GMOs. And I wish they had given more examples, such as what I see in my work, where farmers in less developed countries, which is, you know, where 98% of the hungry people in the world are in less developed countries, that these people are able to produce more and feed themselves better and raise their standard of living best by using sustainable organic farming practices. And we've been seeing that for more than 15 years now in our work, and we're also seeing more and more comprehensive studies coming out that are also showing that sustainable organic growing systems feed people better than the chemical-intensive systems that seem to be, and the genetic engineering that seem to be the focus of many of the speakers at the conference.
Okay. One of the issues that was brought up, too, I know that you were also in attendance at the conference, was the question of infrastructure, so that even if people are growing, able to grow crops in different areas using organic practices, that in Africa, for example, in Southeast Asia and other parts of the world, getting those foods from where they're grown to, for example, cities where mm-hmm. there is a difficult, it's very difficult to raise enough food in a city to feed 14 million people. That infrastructure seemed to be a real issue. Has that been your experience in your work with Sustainable Harvest?
Yes, I definitely can agree that is a difficulty for many of the small-scale poor farmers in the world and for getting their crops to some of the bigger markets. But that said, I think 70-80% of people living in poverty and people facing malnutrition live in rural areas. So I think that even if we just start by focusing on making sure that those people that are already living in farming communities can feed themselves right there in their communities, that we could do a tremendous amount of good by focusing just on that. And then beyond that, certainly it would be helpful if there was better transportation to get the excess crops grown by the farmers in those areas to the bigger markets in the cities.
Now, in your work, which deals with people where they are, here in the United States, as you've pointed out, relatively speaking, relative to the rest of the world, we have much more food than many other places available to us. Are there things that people in the United States can do to help others in the world?
Well, I think that here in the United States, well, we can help our own farmers, as has been discussed, by buying locally the things that can be produced locally and that are produced locally. Then beyond that, for things like coffee or chocolate or sugar or some of the food products that we probably will want and that cannot necessarily be grown locally, I encourage people to buy organic, to buy fair trade, to buy those sorts of products that most likely are grown by small-scale family farms that are using practices that benefit all of us from an environmental standpoint, and also help those farmers to keep their families out of poverty and keep a decent standard of living for themselves.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your comments and suggestions.
All right, well, thank you. And if I may put in a very quick plug, if the weather doesn't stop us, we'll be doing a presentation at 6 o'clock this evening in the Ellsworth Library if people would like to know more about the sustainable practices that are helping people out of poverty in Central America.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yep. Okay, bye-bye.
And I think we have another caller. Caller, if you could just give your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning. This is Joe in Tremont. Representative Pingree gave an interesting appeal to policy, but frankly, I believe that policy is wrong-headed. There certainly are inequitabilities in the food distribution system, and organic agriculture is, without a doubt, the sustainable way to go. Organic agriculture cannot be expanded infinitely into marginal lands without water. And I didn't hear the question of water addressed. Now, the increasing the food base will pretty much guarantee an increase in the human population. And where will that put us in another 30 years? We'll be right in the same boat of needing to make more food. It makes more sense to create a certain sustainable level which provides equitable living for people around the world, but doesn't provide an incentive for out-of-control population growth. Thank you for putting on this program, and thank you to everyone for supporting Community Radio.
Great. Thank you very much, too. I believe we have another caller. Could you give your first name and where you're calling from?
Oh, thank you, Jim. It's Jody in Harborside. I started to be interested in the Camden Conference this year when I heard that there were a number of participants who are promoting genetically modified crops. One of them, a Monsanto scientist, and a number of others who were pushing the same message, and no participants who are scientists and have the credentials to refute that message. I could see that this was very much a setup to prove a particular point. And in the course of my looking into some of the background, I was particularly interested in Jonathan Foley, who didn't end up going to the conference. But nevertheless, I found that he had been one of the people interviewed in a New York Times article in October of 2009 titled, Can Biotech Food Cure World Hunger? Which was, I'm sure, what was part of the the substrate for the Camden conference. And there were three other people, economists, nutritionists, all of whom were promoting the GMO message, who were interviewed for that article, along with Vandana Shiva and Raj Patel. Now, they at least gave balance, and they would have been the kind of people that we would expect the Camden conference to have included, but they didn't. I drifted into the final panel on Sunday just to see how things concluded, and I, my worst suspicions were borne out. The people who were there who could have at least given some refutation, although they were not scientists and couldn't speak in any depth, didn't confront the biotech promoters, and the message was somewhat elliptical in all of the instances. One of the biotech promoters suggested that people go to Africa and see how bad things are there. So I really hope that those who went to the conference and those who didn't for one reason or another, or who are concerned about this kind of disinformation being put out at a major event like this, we'll find a way to redress the balance. One possible way is to join the March Against Monsanto, which is being planned for sometime this month, I believe. The organizer who did it last year in Rockland is planning to do it again. And just look for ways to challenge the people who didn't speak up. I thought Kathleen Merrigan's presentation was pathetic. Shelley Pingree could have said much more about the way the agricultural system is being hijacked by biotech, and after a certain amount of cross-contamination takes place, the question of organic will be moot. So it really challenges all of us to make something more of this than what came through the Camden conference. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Once again, if you would like to join in the conversation, if you have a comment or a question or a reaction to the presentations we heard this morning, the number is 1-866-625-9378. 9378 is also WERU, which is, in fact, the radio station that you're listening to at the moment, WERU-FM, here in Blue Hill and in Bangor and all over the world at weru.org. I think we have another caller. Caller, could you please give your first name and where you're calling from?
Hi, I beg your pardon for calling back a second time. I just wanted to give my support to the woman who just called in. It's so good to hear when somebody else thinks like you do. And when she expressed her frustration with biotech representatives at the Camden conference, I was shocked to hear a Monsanto representative was going to be there. I was ill in my stomach, and I was wondering who was responsible for making those choices. And the woman who just called in, my phone number is 244-5054, and if she'd be willing to call me, I'd like to have some more information. She was so eloquent and articulated, and it was so right. GMO's not the way to go. And I so appreciate you taking my call once again. Thank you very much to that woman who just called in. I appreciate it. Peace be with everyone today. Eat organic and think of the children in the world who are starving as we speak. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. In answer to how people are chosen, the Camden Conference has a program committee, and they are all volunteers, and they work all year long to decide on who can be people to speak at the conference. And then, of course, there's a question of who's available to speak as well. The Monsanto, the fellow who is a scientist and works at Monsanto and was a presenter at the conference, David Gustafson, mentioned that he felt a bit like Daniel in the lion's den, actually, although that doesn't seem to be the impression of these two recent callers anyway. But one of the things that he did say was that he was very interested, and he thought other people were too, but he was speaking personally. He said he was very interested in hearing from and talking with other people, and he invited the entire anyone in the audience to come and visit him at his lab. So that might be something that someone might be interested in taking him up on. I don't know where his lab is, but I'm sure if you go to the Camden Conference website, you can get more information about that. The number is 1-866-625-9378 if you would like to join in the conversation and offer a comment about either what we heard this morning or about anything that has to do with that larger question of the global politics of food and water. And one of the callers did mention that water is a key aspect, and neither of the speakers on this morning's program addressed that directly. However, the first in the series of programs that we have broadcast on the Camden Conference was a talk given by Andrew Guzman on Overheated, the Human Cost of Climate Change, which is also the title of a book he's written, and which is focused very, very heavily on water. And so you'll be able to hear that on the WERU archive shortly if you would like to, and his book is also available if you're interested in that. I think we have another caller. If you'd like to give your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, I'm Laura, and I'm calling from Bar Harbor, and I just have two things to say. One is that, as I understand, GMOs is about the patent. Therefore, they own the seed, and I think that is an important thing. I think it's lovely to think about feeding the world, but I don't believe that that is what they are driven by. They are about, and they meaning biotech industry, because it's about owning the seed. And my second comment, too, is that all that I've been hearing in the Camden Conference this week and last week, it's all about the mind and the doing. And I wonder, where does the sacred come into any of the work that we're doing? I believe we have to change our thinking about how we see and how we feel about each other, about the world, about nature, about water. And that's not a small task. So thank you so much, and that'll be it.
Thank you very much as well. One of the speakers, in fact, the keynote speaker at the Camden Conference, was Fred Kirschenman, and we did broadcast his presentation last week. It will also be available on the WERU archives. And interestingly enough, in addition to being an organic farmer, whose family has been for generations farming in North Dakota, he's also a philosophy professor at Iowa State University, and he's written a book called Cultivating an Ecological Conscience, Essays from a Farmer Philosopher, and spoke a lot about that idea of having a changing, basically evolving our way of thinking about our food and our water and our world. And so if that is of interest, you might want to listen to that presentation when it's up on the archives. That should happen probably within a week or so, or take a look at his book if you'd like to do that. Again, 1-866-625-9378. We have a few minutes left if you'd like to get in a last comment or question or suggestion about either what you've heard today or about that larger question of global politics of food and water. The interesting patents are a very interesting issue and were addressed several times during the conference. One of the speakers mentioned that patents, of course, are a very big issue in the United States and in a few other countries. I believe he said that seeds can actually be patented only in 5 countries in the world. And so in the rest of the world, patents don't cover seeds, and so it's a different kind of situation. But of course, the the countries like the United States are very large countries and very large producers. It's interesting that the question of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, which has been brought up and was brought up several times, mostly in passing at the conference. The distinction was never made there and is often not made in the press between transgenic and other kinds of genetically modified organisms. So, for example, a tomato that has a gene from a frog in it is one kind of genetic modification. Another kind of genetic modification, which is by far the more common one at present anyway, is to essentially speed up plant breeding within a species. And so that is a kind of effort that's going on at many universities, whether that is genetically modified or not from different people's perspective varies quite a lot depending on how one looks at the problem. In the United States, genetically modified foods are basically corn and soybeans at the moment. But most of those foods, most of those crops are used, in the case of corn, either for livestock feed or for biofuels, for better or worse, in either case. And only about 1.4% of genetically modified corn actually finds its way into our food system at the moment. We've got one last caller on the line, and if you'd like to, please give us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, good morning. My name is Diane. I'm calling from Liberty. And the issue of GMOs, you would need to do a program and another program to cover all the dangers and the hazards, so I won't go into any of that. But the presentations at the Camden Conference supporting GMOs, it was, I think, a very poor choice considering what the effort has been in this state to try and get a GMO labeling bill passed, and the fact that it got so watered down before it did pass, and it still faces an uphill battle for enactment with very many technical details it's facing. I also wanted to thank Jody for her comments. The woman that called right after her mentioned how eloquent Jody was and how she spoke to the essential details. And I wanted to add my commendation as well and would like to follow up with Jody. And thank you very much for putting this program on. I know the time is short, so I will relinquish my time and let you move forward.
Good. Thank you very, very much. I think that's pretty much the time that we have available today. Again, if you would like to listen to any of the programs that we have broadcast from the Camden Conference, you can go to www.weru.org and go to the Public Affairs Archives. They will be up shortly. The Camden Conference website itself has a lot of information from the conference on the topic, including a very long reading list and film list, and some of the titles, at least based on the comments we've had this morning, might be surprising to some of the callers, but there's quite a wide range of information there that's available. And the Camden Conference also makes unedited video presentations available, so if you missed the conference, you could conceivably watch and listen to most of it if you'd like to do that. Thanks very much for listening. You are tuned to Community Radio, WERU-FM at 89.9 in Blue Hill, at 99.9 in Bangor, and all over the planet at weru.org.
Support for WERU health-related programming comes from the Penobscot Bay Press, committed to